Hello and welcome to In the Booth here on Sportsnet 650, your official home of the Vancouver Canucks. I'm Brendan Batchelor, as always, joined by Randeep Janda as we discuss the latest with the Vancouver Canucks every week. And Randeep, Canucks ended up the road trip with a pretty good run, three straight victories in Florida, Philadelphia, and most recently Tuesday night in Chicago. We're going to get to that in a moment, but we put out a call for mailbag questions this week, and we were inundated with tons of reaction and tons of thought from Canucks fans. So we're going to talk about the road trip off the top here. We're going to discuss a little bit of a skirmish that happened at Canucks practice on Wednesday as well. And then we're going to break early and dedicate at least half an hour to the questions from the listeners, because we got so many this week.
Let's go. We got a lot to talk about, and especially that road trip, which started off a little shaky, but ended up perfect.
Yeah, so ultimately three straight wins for the Canucks, and I think we could nitpick things about each game, whether it be, you know, some of the defensive lapses that allowed the Blackhawks to score. Certainly that's what comes to mind in the most recent game, whether it's the fact that, yeah, you beat Florida, but you had to go to overtime and they didn't have Tkachuk and Barkov in their lineup. But hey, 6 points out of the final three games of the road trip is what it is. And this is a team that, you know, coming off the slow start to the year, the talk at the start of the road trip was how long is it going to be before they get their first win. And now we can sit back here and look at their record and say they have points in five of six games and they only have one regulation loss.
Most importantly, they pick up the 2 points in those three games to end off the road trip. And as this road trip went on, their process for the most part got better. 5-on-5, their game was better, right? Like in that Chicago game, I know there are a couple of breakdowns where you don't necessarily like. Chicago gets a late goal, of course. But, you know, the Taylor Hall goal, I thought that was unlucky more than a breakdown. Of course, the other goal in that game was more defensive miscues. But late in the game, Vancouver had that lead, you know, 6-2. They were done and dusted. They took a couple of penalties there. There's certain things you can clean up for sure, but I thought 5-on-5, they played a pretty tidy game. Go back to the Philadelphia game. When you're up 3-0, there's certain tendencies where the other team is going to push. And yeah, you needed your goaltender to bail you out a little bit. There were 5 posts in that game. But once again, most important thing is you get the 2 points. And now you come back to Vancouver feeling confident in your game, but also understanding that you need to do better, that you need to round out your defensive game, that certain players still have to elevate their game. And I'm not talking specifically about Elias Pettersson. I'm also talking about some of the players on the back end. You know, Carson Soucy and Tyler Myers had some questionable games as well. But the fact is that they, you know, they won 3 of those 4 games. And that's a good situation to be in, where you're getting results, but also understanding you can do a little bit better.
And I also wonder if this road trip will be seen as the trip where a new line emerged for this group. And that, of course, is the Heinen, Bluger, Sherwood line, who have put together some pretty good games here for the Canucks to conclude the road trip. And, you know, you and I were talking about it during the game against the Blackhawks, as we were calling it. But, you know, we talked about the third line last year. This might be the new third line with the way that they've played to start the year.
And the connective tissue there is Teddy Bluger, who is, in a lot of ways, just a confident, stable player. He's got 4 points in 6 games, showing some offense. But we know defensively he is, you know, airtight. He's a player that is so strong on the back check. He's good in the faceoff circle. But Kiefer Sherwood, physicality, 33 hits in 3 games. He's got 3 assists. And Danton Heinen's impact on that line immediately just wasn't really fitting in with JT Miller. Wasn't, you know, getting to his spots quick enough. Didn't really see it in 1 game with Elias Pettersson. But in 2 games with Bluger and Sherwood, he's got 2 goals. He's got 6 shots on goal. And you just notice him on the forecheck being aggressive. I thought that line, very much like the third line from last year, they announced themselves on this road trip, especially on the latter half.
And shouts to Kiefer Sherwood for the huge hockey IQ play on that review for offside before the one Canuck goal in the first period on Tuesday that ultimately I'm still having to try and explain to people on Twitter because they don't understand it. And I want to talk to Sherwood to find out if that's something he did on purpose or whether it was just a happy accident, because if it was a purposeful play by him, that's a very high hockey IQ decision to play the puck back in, tag up and then touch and go into the zone. And ultimately, it allowed the Canucks to score that goal at a pretty critical moment late in that first period and continue to build on their lead. All right, I touched on it off the top, but Twitter was abuzz on Wednesday because of an incident at Canucks practice. And I've got to ask you for your opinion on this because you were there and I wasn't. It's like the one day that I wasn't at Canuck practice, something super interesting happened. So take us through the situation. Take us through what happened as there was a little skirmish between JT Miller and Elias Pettersson on Wednesday at Rogers Arena.
Well, Batch, it was like any other practice, like any other day. They were going through a drill.
I can hear a harp playing in the background.
This is like a fairy tale that goes kind of sideways, but that's all right. There's a drill near the blue line, and a battle is going on, and JT Miller's playing Elias Pettersson pretty hard. Don't really think anything of it. And at the end of the play, Pettersson slashed JT Miller's stick, which led to a cross check from JT Miller, kind of in the shoulder area of Elias Pettersson, and knocking the Canucks star to the ice. And eventually words were exchanged and they skated away. It was a heated moment and a couple of the teammates got in the way. Punches were not thrown. There was not, you know, yelling back and forth and all of that. It wasn't a big, huge issue, but it was a show of, you know, some physicality from the Canucks top stars. Pettersson didn't seem to like the way that Miller was playing him on that one drill, and there's a little bit of passion, a little bit of heat between the two top centers of the Vancouver Canucks, which in a way is what you want to see. You know, practice getting heated is not necessarily a bad thing.
No, it's not. And in fact, it's something that we see, I don't know, like 3 or 4 times a year, maybe. That might be a little high, but like we were talking about this before coming on the air, I can remember multiple skirmishes where Connor Garland got into it with teammates because of battle drills and things like that. This is something that happens. It's a highly competitive environment. These are guys that want to have success. And I'm not going to read into this too much because it's one small incident at one practice. I don't think it's like a symptom of a larger issue or anything like that. And I don't think we need to, you know, go into conspiracy theories about what it might mean for the Canucks going forward. My only takeaway is that I like it because it means both of these guys care. Both of these guys want to have success. Both of these guys were battling. And in the heat of the moment, if tempers boil over, even with your teammates, that can be a really good thing in terms of driving competitiveness. And what have we heard Patrick Alvin talk about basically since the day he arrived as Canucks GM? Practice habits. And you want them to be better. So these two guys getting at each other in practice and getting under each other's skin, I think is actually a great thing for this team.
And, you know, you're at the practices, as am I. We've seen others, even going back to last year, I remember when Nikita Zadorov messed up a drill or didn't, perform it to the way that JT Miller wanted. JT was giving him a ribbing on the way to the bench and giving him not necessarily a yelling matchup, but just letting him know he messed it up. So this is not something that is unique to a practice. There was Dakota Joshua and Connor Garland getting into it last year, and they're the best of friends. Philip Ronick and Connor Garland got into a pretty heated battle as well. And remember, last week when Elliot Friedman and 32 Thoughts released that podcast, Ronick was talking about kind of the back and forth him and Connor Garland have. So, of course, I think in this situation, you know, the passion is a good thing. Two players that care. And this is what you see on teams. You see the top players challenging each other. Can it get heated? Can it get physical? Can there be cross checks and slashes? Yes, there are. And that's a sign of two players caring. Now let's see what it translates against the opposition. You can show that passion in practice. That's a good sign. You got to see it on the ice when you're playing Pittsburgh and Carolina and New Jersey this week as well.
And I think for any fan of the Canucks, whether you're someone that believes in Elias Pettersson, whether you're someone that has been critical of Elias Pettersson, having this guy show a bit of passion and get into one of these exchanges, I think is probably only a good thing as he looks to try and trend his game in the right direction. All right, Randeep, we mentioned it. We're going to get out here really quick from the first segment so we can get to the mailbag and answer the questions of the listeners. We'll do that when we return on In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to In the Booth on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650. Brandon Batchelor and Randeep Janda with you. If you've missed any part of the show, it lives as a podcast as well on the Canucks Central podcast feed. Make sure to subscribe to that. You get the daily show with Sat and Reach. You get every Canucks post-game show with Sat and Bic. And you get In the Booth every week with myself and Randeep. And at this point in the show, Randeep, always take an opportunity, or at least the past couple of weeks I have, to plug the Canucks Autism Network Pro-Am Hockey Tournament that's coming up in just over a week now. I'm raising money up until Friday of this week. So depending on when you're listening to this, it might be past the deadline, but I'm taking submissions in my draw for a pair of tickets to the game against Carolina on Monday the 28th up until Friday the 25th. I'm going to do the draw on Friday. So a $25 donation gets you one entry for the tickets, $50 two entries, $75 three entries, so on and so forth. If you retweet my post on Twitter and DM me a pic of your donation receipt, I'll give you an additional entry, and I'll give you another entry if you mention that you heard about it on In the Booth, and use the link in the tweet that's pinned to the top of my Twitter at Batch Hockey to make your donation. Let's help out the Canucks Autism Network, and hey, you might get a chance to go to the game as well. And on top of that, Kevin Woodley has organized a separate raffle draw for our team at Sportsnet 650 as we try to raise funds. I've also retweeted that raffle draw on my social media, but you can go to Kevin Woodley at Kevin Is In Goal on Twitter and get tickets for a draw that has signed jerseys, has game tickets, a broadcast booth tour, all sorts of great things. So either way, we don't mind. You're supporting the Canucks Autism Network, and we'd love to see you support our efforts to fundraise for the Pro-Am here at Sportsnet 650. All right, Randy, we said we were going to commit a lot of time to the mailbag on today's show because we put out the call for questions as always, and the listeners responded and responded in droves. So we wanted to make sure that we had time to get to these. And let's begin with Justin in East Van, who says, after a strong finish to the road trip, how will the Canucks perform on their upcoming three-game homestand?
Well, they've got some pretty good teams that they're playing against here, starting off with Pittsburgh. And I know Pittsburgh's kind of been up and down. A lot of questions with that team when it comes to goaltending. But the fact is, you've got a team with star power, with players that can make a difference. I think, you know, you have to be very, very careful with the Pittsburgh Penguins, Carolina, and then the New Jersey Devils. So all three of those teams come with an element of danger. I think if you can get two out of three, you're happy. You know, obviously a 600 point percentage would be make anybody happy, but you know, a couple of those games, Pittsburgh notably won. I think the Devils, they've got the firepower, but they've also pretty leaky defensively at times. I think on the next three games at home here, the Vancouver Canucks, the way that they're trending, I like two out of three on this homestand.
Yeah, that would be the goal, and then anything above that would be gravy. A couple of things I want to note. I think that game against New Jersey could be incredibly entertaining. You talk about the way they play, and we've seen the Canucks at times play some really wild and wide-open periods to this point in the season. The first period against Chicago on Tuesday comes to mind, so that game could be one worth the price of admission. And then the Penguins game is one the Canucks need to take advantage of, because although it's their first game at home coming off the road, 3 days between games after playing Tuesday in Chicago before the Saturday game against the Penguins, and the Penguins are playing the Oilers Friday night. So it's a second half of a back-to-back with travel for the Penguins, whereas the Canucks will have been at home, will have had some practice time, will have had a day off in there this week too. So, you know, we talk about schedule losses all the time in terms of, you know, how we analyze how a team should perform in a certain game. And I haven't had a chance to look at the betting odds officially for that game, but I would imagine the Canucks will be the favorites on Saturday night against the Penguins to begin the homestand because of that fact.
For sure, and I think with that game specifically, you're looking at a couple of things going on in Pittsburgh, just monitoring what's going on with that team. Tristan Jarry, not the greatest to start to the season. Nedeljkovic is the starting goaltender as of right now. Who the Canucks will see on that second of a back-to-back, I guess we're going to have to wait and see. The other thing is Sidney Crosby, oddly enough, hitting a bit of a rut here to start the season, which is extremely rare to hear about Crosby. I know some reporters in Pittsburgh were saying, this is kind of weird, but he doesn't look all that great right now, which is a very rare thing to say about Sidney Crosby. So we'll see. It's the second of a back-to-back. There's no gimmies in the NHL, but you're right. That Pittsburgh one on Saturday, playing against an Edmonton team that is going to be a tough task, and then traveling and then playing Vancouver. Looking at the first game, you got to take care of business against Pittsburgh.
Next question comes in on Twitter from Princess Erica 84, who says, Sherwood is reminding me a lot of Alex Burrows. Do you think he has the potential offensively to be a Burrows-like player for the Canucks? And I think that's a really interesting comparison because, of course, Burrows was seen as like a high energy, great story guy that had battled his way from playing in the ECHL to being on the NHL roster. And ultimately, that sort of shifted for him when he was deployed in a top six role, more specifically with Daniel and Henrik Sedin, and became sort of the triplet on that line and found a unique chemistry with them. And that's where his career took off in terms of being an offensive producer. Do I think Sherwood's capable of that? Yeah, I think there is a possibility he could be that kind of player. But in order to have those sorts of results, he needs to have better deployment up the lineup. And right now, that third line with him and Bluger and Heinen have been playing very well. So I don't see it happening in the immediate future. But, you know, what could happen with a guy like him is, let's say they have an injury in the top six, a winger goes down, and suddenly he is given the opportunity to play with JT Miller or to play with Elias Pettersson. Then it will be up to Kiefer Sherwood as to what he does to make the most of that opportunity. And if he can produce while still being the kind of player that we've seen where he gets under the opponent's skin, he lays the body on the forecheck, he does all the things that the coach loves, then certainly I think like that's Alex Burrows to me is like Kiefer Sherwood's ceiling. Like in a best case scenario, Kiefer Sherwood could be Alex Burrows.
Yeah, I think we got to revisit how good Alex Burrows was, right? This is a player that started off his career in a full season scoring 31 points, which is not that far off or not that, you know, far off from what Kiefer Sherwood's career high is thus far, 27 points in a season, and eventually made it up to 67 points for Burrows, a guy that scored 35 goals. So yeah, that's very good production. That's a player from 2006 pretty much until, you want to say 2012, was playing 70-plus games, did that for six straight years. We're talking about three 82-game seasons in a row, and on top of that, another 80-game season. So durability is important. Deployment is obviously something that's important. And, you know, if you're trying to hit the Burrows level of, A, sticking in the top six and getting production, we're looking at hitting another 20 points in a season if you're Kiefer Sherwood or thereabouts. So I think there's a couple of things that he has to do to even think about that level of production is consistency. You got to make sure that in that third role that you continue to pile up the points, you continue to play a physical brand of hockey, but you got to find chemistry with one of those two top lines. And, you know, as we've seen, it's not the easiest thing to do. That's what was special about Alex Burrows was that he knew what he had to do in that role when he was playing with the Sedins. He understood that he's not going to match up skill-wise. So are you able to get into the middle of the ice, the inside of the ice? Are you able to win, you know, puck battles? I think, obviously, Kiefer Sherwood has elements of that. But you also have to be a very, very smart player like an Alex Burrows was. Not saying Kiefer Sherwood isn't, but that's something he still has to show at a high end when you're playing in the top six. We'll see if he gets there.
Yeah, it's a best case scenario for him, for sure. So we'll see. Again, I like the role he's playing right now, the physical element he brings. Obviously, that line has been great to this point in the season. So happy with what he's doing now. And hey, maybe there is more there down the road. But for the moment, he's been one of the better Canucks. And I think fans can be pleased with that. Next question from Lanny Wadkins on Twitter, who writes in and says, has DeBrusque contributed as expected yet? And I think this is an interesting conversation to have, especially in the wake of him being pulled off the first power play unit for the game in Chicago. My short answer to this question is no, But I think it's also understandable, Randeep, because this is a guy coming to a new team for the first time in his NHL career. Chemistry is not something that's going to be automatic. Understanding and executing the new system that your coach wants you to play is not going to be automatic. Understanding and executing the power play with the way that your coaches want to do it is not going to be automatic either. So has DeBrusque been as impactful as I hoped he might be early in the year? No, but I personally have a pretty long leash for him in terms of giving him some time to figure things out with this group and in his individual game too.
Yeah, that being said, you know, he's still got 4 points in six games, so the stats are kind of there, but you're right, that fit hasn't been quite there. And I think a couple of things. When we're talking about the five-on-five game, the majority of the ice time he's had has been with Elias Pettersson earlier this year. And we all understand, we all recognize that Elias Pettersson is not his usual self in the sense that he's not the most confident puck carrier right now. He's seeing a little bit less of the puck. And even though his last two games have been better, we're still seeing Connor Garland carry more of the puck on that line. So I think DeBrusque, when Pettersson is playing a confident style, when the puck is more on his stick, I think DeBrusque is actually in a better position to play alongside Pettersson. So part of this is Jake DeBrusque still downloading how to play the system, how to get incorporated into that team and play a little bit more effectively. I also think part of it was Elias Pettersson not playing his game and they're not able to work off each other because Petey hasn't been there either. Now, when you look at the power play, I had a good chance to chat with DeBrusque a couple of weeks ago and he really broke down a couple of things in that bumper spot to say, you know, it's a really big download for him because he didn't play that role in Boston. Patrice Bergeron was in the bumper spot, so he was deployed elsewhere. And the other thing is that JT Miller is such a skilled player at that left half wall when he's up there that as a bumper guy, you have to really see the play two plays before Miller gets the puck. You have to be watching the puck and also at the same time be watching Miller, even when Miller doesn't have the puck, to understand his tendencies and understand what he's going to do. So I think for a lot of us, we want to see that production on the power play in the bumper spot. We want to see it automatic like Bo Horvat when he was going top corner on a lot of goals, whether it was one-timer or a, you know, a grip-it-and-rip-it type of shot. But I feel like with Jake DeBrusque, it's a lot of learning going on. You have to pick up those tendencies. And Batch, we know in the preseason, they really had one line or one game together before they got going. So I think there's a lot to download. But also, five-on-five, it's just been – it hasn't been the right chemistry thus far for DeBrusque. I think he'll get there, but we also have to acknowledge that Pettersson not being his usual self also has an impact on his line mates.
Yeah, and I mean, he's played on a bunch of different lines too. He was on Pettersson's line. He was on Bluger's line for a game. He's been playing with Miller most recently. So hasn't necessarily found a home yet within this lineup, and that's going to play a factor as well. And these are things that are going to come with time. But I think the point you make that he's still producing in spite of the fact that maybe he hasn't been the most impactful player on games is an indication that he's a very good player that's going to find a way to have an impact on games, even if it's not like the goal-scoring, dominating kind of performance that fans might have hoped for when he was signed as a free agent to that big deal in the summer. JT Miller time, we got a couple of questions about him. The first one from Travis, who asks, is the same preseason non-injury related to the non-injury that is preventing Miller from taking faceoffs right now? And the short answer to this question is, we don't know if it's the same injury. We don't know if it's a different injury because JT Miller and the organization have been very tight-lipped about his status and exactly what is going on there. But let's put it this way. I think it's clear that JT Miller has not yet played a game at 100%. And much like I was just saying about DeBrusque, Randeep, even though he's not necessarily at the level that you'd like to see him, he's finding a way to impact the game. I think you can say the same of JT Miller, who may not be able to take many faceoffs right now, but is still finding a way to give the Canucks good minutes and some production while playing through at least one, if not potentially multiple injuries right now.
Yeah, JT's a gamer when it comes to picking up, 3 points in a game that he's not 100% healthy. You mentioned the faceoffs. And we don't know, going back to that first game of the season against Calgary, even there was the clip and the interview with Anthony Mantha after that game saying, hey, I challenged him to fight, and he said he was battling an injury, and that's really, we knew something was up, you know, in the preseason. JT had sat out for pretty much all of the preseason games except one, but that was really the first time that we heard, okay, you know, he was managing it in-game in the regular season, and now we know that a lot more because we've seen the face-off issue, we've seen maybe him grimacing a little bit. One thing is for sure, I think he is obviously battling through something. Now, to your point, is it multiple things? Is it one thing? We don't know, but the production is there, and that's really all you can appreciate about a player like JT Miller. He's treating this as a situation where it's like, I got to play through this. My team needs me. And as this was going on, Batch, I did have this thought to say, was that Chicago game really necessary? And I know JT Miller is always going to play. He's an absolute gamer. He doesn't want to take any games off. He's missed three games in the last 3 years due to injury. And, you know, another game on top of that when it was the final game of the year and he was being rested because they didn't need him to play. But when you've got Tuesday as a game and then you've got pretty much the rest of the week off, I wouldn't have been – I'm not surprised JT played, but I would not have – I would have understood if they said, you know what, we don't need you for this game. We're going to go without you. We want you to be rested for Saturday. But that obviously depends on, you know, the issue that he's going through. But, you know, I'm not surprised anytime JT hits the ice because you can see the passion. You can see that he is somebody that is not going to take a shift off. But it was nice to see him only play, what, 16 minutes and change. So he didn't have to go a 20-minute game, which is giving him a little bit of rest even within that game.
And he still had a goal and two assists in only 16 minutes of ice time, too. Also, should note, he only played 17 minutes against Philadelphia after being, you know, above 20 minutes for the previous three games. And part of that will be because he left in the first period for a little while before coming back after that awkward sequence off the opening faceoff. But I think it is worth noting that it looks like through two games since he suffered this injury, the Canucks are limiting his minutes a little bit. And that's a factor as well. And that kind of leads in from what you were talking about to the next question we get from Mark Strange on Twitter, who says, if JT Miller is not at 100%, would it not be better to have him sit early in the season rather than keep playing before something gets worse? I appreciate that he's contributing, but still. And that kind of ties into what you were talking about with the Blackhawks game. Now, I think the hope would be that 3 days between games would be a situation where he can get some rest. He can get, you know, some pain alleviation or some work done on whatever this issue is so that, you know, he doesn't have to miss games. But I do ultimately agree with Mark that, you know, as much as it's important for the team to get out to a strong start and they want to play well, it's more important to have JT Miller healthy in April and May and hopefully June than it is to have him playing games in late October against non-playoff teams on a Tuesday night on the road like he did against the Blackhawks.
Yeah, as I mentioned, in the Chicago game, I would have been completely fine with them saying, hey, he's going to take a day here. And you saw at the opening faceoff against Philadelphia, he's dealing with something. But obviously, the medical officials with the team doctors, they have their say. And, you know, we don't know what the situation is. We don't know if by playing it gets any worse or really if there's any risk at all. So I think in that sort of situation, of course, it's something that we think about and saying, hey, just rest him. You need him healthy for the spring. You need him healthy as the season goes on. But based on the condition and based on the injury, maybe it's not going to make that much of a difference. So it is something that I think, with such limited information, Bat, it's really tough to talk about based on the fact that, you know, JT is still contributing to this lineup and putting up 3 points in a game.
Yeah, and we're not doctors. We just play them on the radio, so we can't provide any medical
insight. My parents wish
either.
I was a doctor, but no, I'm not.
Mine too, I'm sure. Jameson on Twitter, at JamesonTB, writes in, and I'm going to read his question first, but let me make it clear that I am not endorsing the way he asks this question, and in fact, I'm going to take issue with the way he asked this question. But Jameson says, quote, why are Oman and Baines, who both provide very little, both still playing over Sprong? End quote. And I disagree that these guys are providing very little.
Get them, Batch. Get them.
I think what I would say is what they are providing is not like the sexy, exciting stuff that you see on the highlight reel. But ultimately, their skill sets, both Omon and Baines, and their reliability in terms of board battles, in terms of defensive responsibility, in Omon's case, in terms of penalty killing ability, in Baines' case, in terms of, you know, being able to chip in a little bit on the power play, although I know if we're comparing him to Sprong, Sprong can do that as well. But this is about trust. This is about reliability. This is about two-way play. And as much as Daniel Sprong has a higher offensive upside and has the ability to score more than both of those guys do at this point in their careers, I would argue anyway. The reason Daniel Sprong's not in the lineup is because he, early in the season, was costing his team goals with missed coverage and poor defensive play. And it's clear, much like they were willing to pull Vincent Desharnais out of the lineup after the first game of the year, that they think he needs to work on these parts of his game. And this is not unexpected either, Randeep. Sprong signed with the Canucks, citing the fact that he knew he had to improve defensively, and he trusted Rick Tocchet to be the guy to help him grow his game. So, you know, I think I've seen a lot of this on Twitter, and it kind of bugs me that, oh, Niels Omon stinks. Why is he in over Sprong? Or, oh, what's Archdeep Baines doing? You know, he should be in the AHL. Like, both of these guys, again, not high-end scorers, but they're not being deployed in top six roles either. They're being asked to play fourth-line minutes and provide heavy defensive zone contributions where they can make nice plays on the boards, where they can bring a little bit of a physical element as well, and they can be trusted when they go out on the ice to not lose an assignment or miss coverage in their own end and give up a goal.
In a word, it is predictability, where coaches across the league, and Rick Tocchet, the way he thinks the game of hockey, the what he expects from his players, if you're given a choice of low risk, low reward versus high risk, high reward, this is a risk-averse league still, right? We can be all aspirational and say, hey, get the most skilled players out there, but if your skilled players have questions defensively, NHL coaches still go with the 200-foot game to say, you're not giving me as much offense, but I know the puck's not going to end up in the back of my net. You're not going to make that fatal mistake that leads to a breakdown or compounds a single mistake. So, you know, that's not to discredit Niels Omon and Archdeep Baines. That's to say, hey, their 200-foot game is much stronger than Daniel Sprong's as of right now, even though their offensive output is going to be limited. As of right now, Daniel Sprong, if he's playing on a fourth line, you're putting him in the lineup for power play too. Like, if he can do something 5-on-5, that's great, but you're looking for that offensive skill to say, hey, on the second power play unit, you're giving us something, you're giving us that shot, and you might be able to generate something on a fourth line that has limited offense. That's something that I understand. You're going to need offense, but if we are having the same discussion in February, March, April, Batch, and the trust isn't there, the predictability isn't there in his game, guess what? He's not going to be playing. So, you know, guys like Niels Omon and Archdeep Baines are going to get that benefit of the doubt because they have that trust. So it's a, you know, Jameson, thanks for the question, but I hope that goes to explain, even though they might not have the offensive output, they have the trust of a coach to say, I know you're not going to compound maybe an original mistake. You're going to be at a much less risk position that potentially a guy with more firepower, but question is, you can put the puck in the opposition's net, but are you going to cause one or two to go in my own net as well? And that's really the deciding factor.
And one thing I would urge fans listening who aren't big fans of Omon or Baines' games to do is the next time you're watching a Canucks game, watch those guys specifically, and specifically watch how they play in the defensive zone, the way they win board battles, the way they get pucks out, the way they use body position to protect the puck. These are the kind of things, right? Yeah, yep. Absolutely. Like all of these skills that, again, like it's not going to end up on the highlight reel that like you made a good play on the boards in the D zone to clear and relieve pressure. But those often can be the difference between getting a clear and getting an important line change or getting hemmed in for 2 minutes and conceding a goal or taking a penalty and going to the penalty kill. So, again, like it's not like sexy highlight reel, like end-to-end goals like Daniel Sprong scored in that preseason game against Calgary. But ultimately, those are the kind of players and the kind of plays that you win with in the long term. And that's why, like, this is a conversation we always have in this market. Like, people would always say, why isn't Goldobin being played in a higher role or being trusted with these minutes? He's such a skilled player. And, you know, he's just one of many guys. Kuzmenko is another one we could talk about. You know, Sprong is the latest example of that right now.
In previous years, it was Nils Höglander, right?
Yeah, exactly.
He's made progress on that front, but we were having this discussion 2 years ago, even last year, with Nils Höglander.
Yeah, we were. So, ultimately, and this is not just a Rick Tocchet thing, ultimately we saw Travis Green do this, we saw Bruce Boudreau do this, we're seeing Rick Tocchet do this, we see coaches from all around the league do this. They trust players that they can rely on. And it's not about offense all the time, especially if you're going to be playing in a bottom six role. Puck Mama on Twitter with the next question. Do either of you have a favorite player to interview? Who gives you the best material for your questions? And this is a recency bias answer because he's a new guy that's come to the team this year. But what I look for in interview subjects, Randy, are guys that will actually answer your question authentically. And this sounds like I'm throwing shade at most players. I'm not, because a lot of these guys are pretty media savvy, pretty well media trained. They know how to handle a lot of these questions, but it doesn't necessarily always come across as them giving you their true opinion or how they really feel. And Jake DeBrusk is a guy that when you interview him, it feels like you're having a conversation with someone over a drink, right? Where he's telling you exactly how he feels. He's listening to your question. He's responding honestly and earnestly. And I find that really refreshing, which, again, like, I'm not trying to throw shade at everybody else, but in a hockey dressing room, there are a lot of cliches, and oftentimes, you know, you get a lot of the same answers or similar answers from guys when you're asking about things that are happening throughout the season. But early in his tenure as a Vancouver Canuck, I've really enjoyed the few conversations I've had with Jake DeBrusk.
Yeah, I can't disagree with you on that one, because he is a player that not only speaks so well and is, you know, very thoughtful in his answers, he's also very thoughtful in his breakdown, you know, especially for a guy that sees the game at such a high level and is playing at the highest level possible right now. He's very, very detailed and, you know, really hockey for dummies at times as well. He does such a good job of breaking down such complicated concepts. So I would say DeBrusk. The other guy that I think, you know, if you're talking about just having an honest and kind of free-flowing conversation, it's nice to have that conversation where the guy's just himself, is another new addition. It's Vincent Desharnais. Desharnais is all personality. You can see the joy in his interviews where he's had to go through a lot. You know, he's a bit of a late bloomer when it comes to the NHL. And of course, there's ups and downs. There's going to be good games and bad games. But the way that he appreciates the moment, the way that he, you know, there's kind of a youthfulness to his answers and how much he enjoys being in the NHL. I would also give Desharnais a bit of a shout there.
Yeah, both of those guys could have a future in media if they want after their careers. And I think that's probably a good indication of someone that gives a good answer. Like, Kevin Bieksa was one of those guys in his career, and look how well he's doing now on Hockey Night in Canada. So those are two choices on the current edition of the Canucks. You know, we could look at past years. I think Jay Beagle was a guy that gave really good answers when he was in Vancouver, in spite of the fact that he was always under the microscope. I know you and I both always enjoyed our conversations with Ian Cole, his 1 year with the Canucks. So those are just a few names that come to mind for me. Bob Bluger on Twitter writes in. I don't know if Bob's related to Teddy, but he's at Bob Bluger anyway. Asks,
distant favorite cousin.
Yeah, maybe. Who knows? Favorite hockey team and hockey player when you were a kid. Also, can you share one memorable hockey moment as a kid? So, Randy, I'll let you go first.
Yeah, born and raised in Vancouver. It's not going to be rocket science in terms of deciphering my favorite team growing up, but my favorite player, the Russian Rocket, Pavel Bure. He's the one that got me into hockey.
Mine too, for sure.
And we're in, you know, there's a few years difference between us, but still, there was that, you know, 10-year window where we appreciate Alexander Ovechkin and what he is in the power game and you know, the goal scoring. Pavel Bure was that for the generation before, where he brought power, he brought speed. he brought a cool factor to the game. Even that, you know, that hockey card of him hanging out in his rollerblades, right, sitting on a railing, was the coolest hockey card growing up. Everybody wished they had it. For me, it was Burry, and that was, like, not even close. I know Lemieux played at that point. Gretzky was more than halfway through his career, but there was just an element of Burry and what he did that just wowed you every single time he was on the ice.
And do you have a notable memory, whether it's tied to Burry or the Canucks or anything, in terms of early memory that helped form your hockey fandom and sort of set you on the path that you've gone on now to be a broadcaster in the NHL?
1994, the playoffs were it, and I was 8 years old at that time, and that was really my – I watched hockey, but really that playoff run is what got me into it, and it was Brown to Burry against Calgary. That goal – got me started on being a hardcore fan, but just the beauty of a player going in so fast, so skilled, the meaning of that goal and how big it was, and it was really the start of the Vancouver Canucks going on that unbelievable run. So Brown to Burry for sure.
Yeah, my answers to this are pretty similar. Obviously, growing up in Vancouver, I was a big Canucks fan. I was a big Burry guy as well. But I was also a big Wayne Gretzky guy. And as you said, I'm a few years younger than you. So I was about 5 years old in 94. And that spring, before they went on that playoff run, my dad took me to an afternoon matinee game on a weekend, the Canucks and the Kings at the Pacific Coliseum. So my first NHL game I ever attended, I got to see Pavel Bure. He scored a hat trick. The Canucks won. I got to see Wayne Gretzky. And that moment for me was like the coolest thing that had ever happened in my short five-year life. And, you know, really sort of supplanted me as a hockey fan going forward to see the greatest player in the history of the game and then arguably the most exciting player in Canucks history on the ice on the same game. You know, basically my little five-year-old brain exploded and I've been hockey mad ever since. Time for a couple more questions here. Phil writes in, and this takes a hard turn back into a lot of the conversations we've been having around the current Canucks. Will Petey ever live up to his $11.6 million contract? Thanks, I'll hang up and listen. And I think the answer to this has to be yes, for multiple reasons. The first is that I don't think any of us believe that Elias Pettersson will continue to struggle at the level he has over the last 40-ish games dating back to the All-Star break last year. And the other factor here, Randeep, and I said this at the time when they signed this deal, when people were saying, oh, that's a lot of money to pay for this guy. The salary cap's going to go up. Contracts are going to be inflated. And if Pettersson can both find his game and we see where the economics of the NHL are heading, I think that'll be seen as a value deal in a few years.
Yeah, the percentage of the cap is going to go down over time. So definitely on that front. But it is something that I think the larger sample size shows us that Elias Pettersson is a much better player than he's shown us in the last, 40 games of his NHL career. That's on Pettersson to get back to that. But the larger sample size shows us that he is that player. $11.6 million is a lot of money. Absolutely. When you're making top five money in the NHL, it's going to be a higher expectation. There's going to be more pressure. There's going to be more of a weight on your shoulders. And I think ultimately the skill that he has is going to rule the day. At some point, you find that confidence. You find that mojo. He's much too skilled to let this drag on that much longer. But $11.6 million, I think he can play it to that level. On his day, he's a top 7 to 10 player in the NHL when he's going. It's been a while since he's hit that level, Batch, but I'm still confident that, you know, a guy that has shown us that he can be one of the most electric players with the passing, with the shot, with the two-way game, skill just doesn't leave you. This isn't Space Jam, and the Monstars haven't just rolled into Vancouver and taken his skill. This is a guy that's going to find it. I'm still confident of that. It's just sometimes you have a bit of a rut here, whether it's mental, whether it's physical, maybe it's a combination of both. But Elias Pettersson is a skilled player that you'd expect at some point in time here to get going again.
All right, we've taken a ton of time here to go through the mailbag, and we're running out of time. So I've got a couple more questions from Twitter. I know you have some from Instagram, so let's go rapid fire here to finish off the show. Vikingstad writes in, when I think of how winning teams look to me over the years, I'm looking at this Canucks team, and I keep saying, why not? Does it actually feel to you guys like with a little good fortune health-wise and a deadline tweak, this squad is capable of the ultimate goal? Capable, I think, yes. but there are a lot of things that have to go right for them, Randeep. And at the top of my list for things that have to go right, in spite of how well Kevin Lankinen's played early in the year, Thatcher Demko has to get back into the lineup and get back to his regular old self, playing at the high level that, you know, had him be the runner-up for the Vezina Trophy last year, in order for me to, you know, openly say, yeah, why not? Why couldn't they go and win the whole thing?
Yeah, that's a major part of it. The other thing I would add is also defense. You know, are you able to add one more piece there? That's the deadline tweak that, of course, the listener mentions. And I'm going to say, I know Teddy Bluger has started the season off really well, but this team probably could use another center, maybe a right shot center. So, you know, there's going to be tweaks that need to be made, because you look at a team like Dallas, you look at what the Edmonton Oilers will probably round out to be, you look at some of the other Western Conference heavyweights, and a few of them have started off rather slow, but you know, one or two teams that I mentioned there are going to be going deep. Do you have enough to beat them in a seven-game series? You need some tweaks, and Thatcher Demko is obviously the addition. Building on that, we got Ogie from Bells and Whistles coming in with, how many games is it realistic to play Demko this year? Will we run like Boston did last year? Basically a tandem, I guess, is the question that Ogie is saying. How many games is it realistic for Demko at this point? That's the million-dollar question, Batch.
Well, especially with some reports here in the last few days that it doesn't seem like a return is imminent for Demko, and we're already into late October. So, like, there's no way you can accurately predict a number on this, because we don't yet know when he's going to be back. Like, if he's back in November, maybe you could say 30 or 40. If he's back in December, maybe you reduce that number to 30 or 25. And with every passing month that he doesn't play, the number comes down. And then this is also dependent on him staying healthy. So, like, my answer to that question is I don't have an answer to that question, because it's such an unpredictable situation, and none of us know when he's going to be back, and none of us know what he's going to look like or how he's going to have to manage the injury when he gets back in. So maybe it does end up having to be a tandem with him and Lankinen, or Shelov's sliding in there too. Maybe he can come back and feel great and carry the mail and play 40 games this year. Like, ultimately, we don't know the answer to that question, and I don't know when we're going to know the answer to that question either.
That is the million-dollar question, and I'm with you. Like, I wish I could give a number, but it would really be just throwing one out at this point in time. It was good to see Thatcher Demko at the most recent practice hanging around the team on the bench, but it still seems like it's quite some ways away.
Okay, last one from Twitter here, at JCOG88. Do we as Canucks fans take the 6-3 win over the Blackhawks with a grain of salt, as it's only Chicago, or should we be happy that we are beating teams like that and keeping Connor Bedard off the score sheet? And my answer, as we're doing rapid fire here, Randeep, is both. Like, you want to be happy that your team played well, scored a bunch of goals, beat a team you should have beat, limited a top player. But at the same time, I'm not going to grade the Canucks on how they play against the Chicagos of the world. I'm going to grade them on how they play against other teams that fancy themselves contenders in the West in particular, but really all around the league.
And I'll keep it even shorter, essentially saying it's about the process. Are you rounding out your process as you go here? You're getting close to the 10% mark of the season. Are you able to play more of a defensive style for Vancouver? Are you able to limit those breakdowns? In the last couple of games, they've been able to do that. Against Chicago, Lankinen made some saves, of course, but you look at the 5-on-5 numbers, they were good, and they're trending in the good direction. So to me, it's not picking up victories, but it's also rounding out your process, which Vancouver is doing.
All right, then that does it for the mailbag segment here on the show. Thanks for tuning in this week to In the Booth. Again, if you missed any part of the show, it lives as a podcast on the Canucks Central feed. I'll be back on the air on Saturday night when the Vancouver Canucks take on the Pittsburgh Penguins. That'll be a entertaining one from Rogers Arena. 7 o'clock faceoff. The pregame show gets underway, as always, at 6 on Sportsnet 650 and along the network. And I'll have Landon Ferraro sitting shotgun with me for that game, Randeep, because you're on Hockey Night in Canada, Punjabi. So what do you guys have coming up on your show this week?
We've got the same Pittsburgh-Vancouver game and Boston and Toronto this weekend, so a couple of key matchups. And I also want to say, shout-out to everybody, if you haven't gotten your tickets for the game on Monday, which is against Carolina, the 28th, that is going to be Diwali night. So I hope to see you there at the rink as well.
And hey, enter the draw that I've got running on Twitter right now for the Canucks Autism Network Pro-Am, and you could win tickets to go to that game and be a part of that evening at Rogers Arena too. But that does it for us on In the Booth this week. We'll talk to you again next week. Keep it locked on your official home of the Canucks, Sportsnet 650.